Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. I'm Mike, your host. This is our weekly YouTube live stream being broadcast live Thursday, January 25th, 2018 at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. This live stream will also be broadcast. This will also be broadcast later as an episode of the Counting to Five audio podcast. If you're watching live, please feel free to ask questions in the YouTube live chat at any time. In the weekly live streams, I review the latest developments at the court, and I'll answer viewer questions submitted in the live chat. And this week, we've got a bunch of interesting new material to talk about. So first of all, we finally have some more opinions of the term. Up until now, the court had only issued one single opinion in an argued case back in November, and we've been waiting for more opinions to start coming out from this term. And Monday this week, that's January 22nd, the court issued three new opinions in argued cases. One of them was unanimous, one was mostly unanimous, and one was sharply divided, a 5-4 split on the court. And in a few minutes, I'll discuss each of these three new opinions. The court also granted two new cases to add to its docket. The first one was on last Friday, January 19th, is Trump v. Hawaii, which is a case coming out of the travel ban litigation. And this case is kind of being rushed, even though it's granted kind of late for this term. It's going to be scheduled for the April argument session, which is the last argument session of the term. So that case is going to be expedited and got onto this year's calendar. So we should have an opinion in that case by the end of the term, which is the end of June before the summer recess. So that's the first of the two cases. And then on Monday this week, January 22nd, the court granted another case called Weyerhaeuser Company v. United States Fish and Wildlife Service. That case will most likely not be argued until next term. Probably that will be argued in the October argument session, the first session of the next term, because the court's April calendar is basically full at this point. So it's very likely that that case is not going to be on this year's calendar. In a few minutes, I will give a quick preview of each of these two new cases also. But first, I'm just going to turn to a few other developments at the court in the last week. The first is in a case called Lucia v. SEC. I discussed this case in last week's live stream. This is a case that the court granted about whether the SEC, that's the Securities and Exchange Commission, whether its administrative law judges were appointed constitutionally. And this one thing I mentioned when I talked about this case was that under the Trump administration, the government had changed positions, and they were actually now siding with the challengers to the SEC's administrative law judge, agreeing that these ALJs, administrative law judges, were unconstitutionally appointed. So that left the case in a strange circumstance where both parties to the case, both sides of the case, are actually on the same side, arguing the same legal position. So what the court did last Thursday is the court appointed an attorney, and the attorney is an attorney named Anton Medlitsky, was appointed by the court to defend the lower court's opinion saying that the SEC's ALJs are constitutional. Mr. Medlitsky is a partner at O'Melveny & Myers, and he is also a former clerk for Chief Justice Roberts. And so he's been tasked with defending the position that neither of the parties want to defend before the Supreme Court. And this is it's a process that they take from time to time when these sorts of situations arise. It's not always a change of position like this. Sometimes it's just that the legal basis, the legal argument on which the lower court decided a case is not one that one of the parties wants to stand by at the Supreme Court. And so there's a position represented by the lower court's opinions that isn't being pushed by the parties. So sometimes the court will invite someone, an amicus, a friend of the court, to come in and take that position. So that's just a development in that case. That case will probably be argued in April. And then, One other development, this also happened on Thursday. There's a case out of North Carolina challenging the congressional district map as a partisan gerrymander, an extreme partisan gerrymander by the North Carolina Republicans. About 2 weeks ago, the three-judge district court held that the map was unconstitutional and ordered the immediate drawing of new maps. North Carolina filed an emergency application with the Supreme Court for a stay. So basically they want to put this order of the district court on hold, the order to immediately start drawing new maps. And they've argued that basically the period for the filing period for their primaries, the primary elections, is about to open. And they argued that this new map process won't be settled before the opening of the filing period. And that's just going to lead to chaos as people don't know, exactly where the district boundaries are and who's in what district and things like that. So, so they argued for, the Supreme Court to do an emergency stay, and the challengers, organizations that were challenging the maps as unconstitutional gerrymanders, they argued, on the other hand, that the stay would basically make it impossible to have new maps in place in time for the 2018 election, so they argued against it. Well, last Thursday, the court granted the stay. There was dissents noted by Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, but there was no opinions. It was just a brief order noted that they dissented from it. The court right now, already this term, has two cases on its docket about partisan gerrymanders. The first is called Gill v. Whitford, and that's a case out of Wisconsin that was argued in October, and we're waiting on an opinion from that case. And the second case is called Benisek v. Lamone, which is a Maryland case that will be argued in the March oral argument session. And an issue that's common to both of those cases, they have some differences, but a common question is whether claims of partisan gerrymanders are even something that the courts are willing to entertain, whether that's even a viable claim to say that a district election map is unconstitutional because of partisan reasons, as opposed to racial gerrymanders, which is well settled in the law that drawing districts according to racial criteria can very well be a constitutional violation. But the court has never said that partisan gerrymanders are something that you can bring a claim for. So those two cases, the Gill v. Whitford and Benisek v. Lamone, the two that the court is already hearing this term, the result of those cases could, in effect, decide the North Carolina case. The fact that the court issued a stay could be seen as a sign that at least some of the justices don't think that these partisan gerrymandering claims can go forward. But you may not want to read too much into that. It may just show that the justices are concerned about, possible chaos in the election season, having, ongoing fights, in the courts over which maps are active, while the beginning of the election season is already underway. But that's a case to watch, as it continues to develop, and we'll see if the court takes any further action on it. And then there's one additional development that just happened. This relates to the DACA program. That's the first, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which was a policy implemented by the Obama administration that allowed renewable two-year deferrals of deportation for certain immigrants who had arrived as children. And the case is called Department of Homeland Security v. Regents of the University of California. And the basic situation is this. In 2012, President Obama, the DHS under the Obama administration, implemented the DACA policy. In September of 2017, the DHS under the Trump administration rescinded the DACA policy and announced that it was winding down, that program. And there were, the policy had been challenged, under President Obama had been challenged. There were several court challenges brought on various grounds saying that it was, unconstitutional and also that it was, not authorized by statute and just challenging the legality of the DACA program. In January of January 9th, so just a few weeks ago in 2018, a court ordered the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, to maintain the DACA program nationwide. They ruled that on procedural statutory grounds that the way that the DHS rescinded the policy was not legal under the statutes. The government appealed this, but they also did something somewhat unusual, which is they petitioned to the Supreme Court for something called cert before judgment. Now, normally, when a party seeks makes a cert petition to the Supreme Court, so that's the formal petition asking the court to take a case, that comes after the case has been heard by the Court of Appeals. So in a typical case, a district court makes some ruling, it's appealed to the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals makes its ruling, and then the party that loses at the Court of Appeals can ask the Supreme Court to take it. But there is a process, it's rarely sought and rarely granted, but it's called cert before judgment, and it lets a party bypass the Court of Appeals altogether. So they're going straight from the district court and going right up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, generally it's a claim of some emergency or urgency where this needs to get decided right away. And what happened is on Tuesday, what the court did was it ordered expedited briefing on the cert petition. So it didn't decide one way or another on this whether it's going to take the case, but it basically ordered the parties to brief the issue of whether it should take the case, basically in time for the court's first February conference where it will decide where it will consider additional cases to take for this term. So that opens up the possibility that the case will be decided this year. The court is at least considering taking this case on the cert before judgment, so taking it right away there. And it means maybe they would order extremely expedited briefing and try and squeeze it into the April argument calendar. Or maybe they would, as they have occasionally done for certain, urgent cases in the past, maybe they would set up a special argument session later in the term in May or some later time in the term to get this on the calendar this year. Again, that's if they even take the case, because we don't know at this point for sure. We just know that they are interested enough in it that they've asked for the expedited briefing to consider it right away. So that's a small development. We'll just have to keep an eye on that and see if they do end up taking the case. And then one more small development is that yesterday, that's Wednesday, January 24th, the March argument calendar was released. There's 9 cases on the March calendar, and this is exactly as expected. There were 9 cases that were had been granted by the court by the end of by December before the winter break this year, and it was expected that those 9 cases would all end up on the March calendar, and then the January granted cases would fill out the April calendar, and that's exactly what happened. So no surprises there. There's 2 cases among those 9 that have been getting the most attention or kind of the most high profile. One of them is a case called National Institute of Family and Life Advocates v. Becerra, and that's a First Amendment challenge to the California FACT Act, which is a law that requires crisis pregnancy centers, and those crisis pregnancy centers are centers run by pro-life organizations that provide counseling and resources for pregnant women, basically to counsel them toward alternatives to abortion or counsel them away from abortion. And the FACT Act, it requires those types of centers to post certain disclosures, including notices that inform people of the availability of abortion services elsewhere. And there's a challenge that's been brought to that, saying that that violates the First Amendment rights of these crisis pregnancy centers by forcing them to convey a message that's counter to their objectives and beliefs. So that's one of the cases that's coming up in March. And then the other high profile case is one that I already mentioned a few minutes ago. It's the Benisek v. Limon, which is the Maryland partisan gerrymandering case. And it's interesting that they already heard the Gill v. Whitford partisan gerrymandering case in October. You know, an opinion in that could come out any time. It's likely to be, a somewhat complicated and contentious case. So it may take the court a while to come out with a opinion on that. So it's just the timing is interesting. It'll be interesting whether, there's a possibility they could have a decision on that before they hear the Maryland case in March. But, it seems likely they'll probably, that'll still be outstanding when the Maryland case, comes around, but we won't know, for a while yet. I had a question in the live chat from Amy, asking whether there are typically a similar number of cases each month, or are there some months that tend to be busier than others? They are somewhat uneven. Back when the court, if you go back, say, 10 or 15 years, when the court had a slightly busier calendar, they had slightly more cases on their docket, they could fill up their calendars each month, and they had enough cases to kind of keep each month's calendar full, and it was much more even. The court, each month it typically has six argument days in each month's session. Sometimes less because of a holiday or something like that, but usually six argument days, and they like to hear two cases per argument day. That's kind of their standard, practice if they have enough cases to fill out the calendar. So that gives you about 12 cases a month, or 10 in some months with holidays. And there was a time when that was pretty consistent. Every month you'd see, 10 or 12, depending on how many days cases. But in recent years, their caseload has dropped quite substantially, and they haven't been hearing enough cases to fill up their calendar every month. So it's been a bit more, uneven. And just depending on what they have, pending, the months are different. And a pattern in a few years, it happened last year and the year before, the end of the term has ended up being a little heavier sometimes. So that's going to happen this year in April. It looks like there's about 12 cases right now that are going to end up on the April calendar, when many other months have been lower. I mentioned March was 9, but there was even a 6-case session, I believe, in November. It was only 6 cases this year. So it's a little backloaded. They had another backloaded term recently also, which is not ideal, because it means that the court has more cases it's hearing at the end of the term, and it's trying to finish up all its opinions for the term by the end of June. So it just creates more of a time crunch if they have a larger number of cases toward the end of the term. If you go back a few more years, the court at one point was attempting to front load its term a little more. They were adding a few extra arguments, even having some 3 argument days instead of just 2 arguments in October at the beginning of the term, to try and front load the term and make it a little easier for them to get everything wrapped up toward the end of the term. And there was even talk that made it into some news articles at the time, that supposedly the court was considering adding extra argument days in October to do that, to bulk up the fall calendar a little more. But things have not played out that way, with the declining docket, and the court's kind of struggled to just grant enough cases to keep themselves busy. So that's answer to that question. And again, any other questions, feel free to ask them in the live chat, and I'll periodically look at that and try and answer those. Finally, one last story from the past week that's not about the court's official business, but is of some importance to the court. On Friday morning last week, paramedics were called to Justice Sotomayor's D.C. home, and it turned out it was a episode of low blood sugar, which is a symptom of her diabetes, which was treated by paramedics. She was fine, went to work, and was that weekend, and has been traveling to planned events just as planned. So it ended up being nothing particularly serious. Justice Sotomayor was diagnosed with diabetes as a child, and this is something she's dealt with and managed for her entire adult life. And by all accounts, her diabetes is well managed. But apparently, the method of diabetes control that she practices, low blood sugar episodes are a known risk of that. What this does do is it highlights how little the public often knows about the health of the justices on the court. One prime example of that is Justice Scalia. In February of 2016, he died unexpectedly. And it came out after his death that he had quite a few fairly serious health problems, major risk factors for sudden death, and that was something that few people knew about. Even though his death touched off huge controversies and battles in the Senate over his replacement, but it was it caught people very unaware because no one knew quite how. Kind of dangerous, I guess, risky his health situation actually was. So this is just kind of illustration of we found out about it only because the paramedics' appearance at her house caught people's attention and made the news. Otherwise, this would have been an aspect of Justice Sotomayor's health condition that the public would be unaware of. So with those things out of the way, I'm going to talk quickly about the two newly granted cases. And the first I mentioned is Trump v. Hawaii. That's one of the travel ban cases. Now, this is not the first time that the travel ban has kind of made an appearance at the court. The history of the travel ban is a little bit complicated. The original travel ban was an executive order from President Trump only a week after he took office in January 27th of last year. And the part of the order that's at issue in this litigation right now was, at that time it was a 90-day entry ban on nationals of seven countries. That was immediately challenged in the courts, and one court issued a nationwide injunction prohibiting, the administration from implementing that order. In March of last year, a second order was issued that superseded the first one, and it fixed some of the worst problems with the original order, but was challenged for many of the same reasons. And there were quickly district court injunctions in several different districts in the country, again ordering the administration not to implement the policy. And these were upheld on appeal in the Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit. On basically two different grounds. One was that the President Trump didn't have statutory authority to issue the travel ban, and the other was that there was a constitutional violation under the Establishment Clause. I'll come back to those in just a second. But what happened at that point was the government sought a review from the Supreme Court in June at the very end of last Supreme Court term. The court issued an opinion and granted cert on the case, so agreed to hear the case. The opinion partially overturned the lower court injunctions and partially left them in place. It was kind of a mixed decision, a win for certain categories of immigrants and a loss for others. But it agreed to hear the case, and also by partially overturning the injunction was allowing a review process, an internal review process, that was part of the original travel ban order, that was allowed to go forward now that the ban was partially in effect. And the important thing there was, so the oral argument in that case eventually got set for October. But those travel bans were, by their own terms, they were explicitly temporary. They were supposed to last for 90 days to allow for internal studies and reviews to take place. Now, that 90-day period from when the court issued its ruling in late June ran to late September, which meant that by its own terms, the ban would expire before oral argument even rolled around. So there was a lot of discussion at that point about whether this case would even still be a live case, whether it would be completely moot by the time argument came around. What ended up happening was, in late September, on the expiration date of the 90-day period, President Trump issued a proclamation, which was basically a new version of the travel ban. Some people are calling this travel ban 3.0. And it made some various changes. It changed the specific countries that were involved in the travel ban. It expanded it to include North Korea and Venezuela. And it also made it, for now, instead of being a 90-day temporary program, it made it permanent, but with a periodic review built into it. What happened then was the court, because of this new development, the replacement of the old travel ban with this version 3, the court removed the case from its October argument calendar and asked the parties to brief whether it was now moot. The parties did that. They filed their briefs, and the court later dismissed the case as moot. It just said that the issue was no longer live now that it had been superseded. So everything was back to the lower courts, where litigation continued over version 3 of the travel ban. And that what ended up happening there is another nationwide injunction was issued against the new version of the travel ban. That went up and was upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and has now been brought from there up to the Supreme Court again. And I'll briefly mention the main issues that are in play in this travel ban litigation. There's some statutory arguments. Now, these arguments are arguments that that the president does not have authority under the statutes to issue the travel ban as it is. And there's two different provisions here. There's one that's called 8 USC 1182F. That's a provision that gives the president authority to bar the entry of any aliens or class of aliens when he determines that their entry would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. So that's the authority that the administration has said justifies the travel ban that's been implemented. The lower court said that this actually did not support it. It said that the president had failed to properly show a detrimental entry of these classes of aliens would be detrimental to the interests of the U.S. And also the court ruled that that provision doesn't allow for indefinite suspension, that it would only allow for suspending entry for some sort of determinate period of time. And the Trump administration has disputed both of these things, has argued that its proclamation actually contains detailed findings after a comprehensive 200 country review, and that there's historical precedent for presidents issuing orders under this provision without explicitly providing the justification for the determination that it's detrimental to the interests of U.S., and that that's not required under the statute. And also that the statute doesn't say anything about there being a fixed term and indefinite suspension is within the president's discretion. So that's the basic arguments under that provision. And then the other provision at issue is called 8 U.S.C. 1152A1A. And that is a provision that says that the important part is that no person shall be discriminated against in the issuance of an immigrant visa because of the person's race, sex, nationality, place of birth, or place of residence. And the argument here is just simply that the travel ban discriminates on the basis of nationality. It says that nationals of certain nations may not enter the United States. And the administration has several responses to this as well. One is that it argues that this provision doesn't even apply to what the travel ban is about. The travel ban is a ban on entry, and this provision only is talking about immigrant visas. And visas and entry, on the government's position, are two distinct things. You can be granted a visa, but then later denied entry for various reasons. And so it's not the same issue. And also there's the argument that this just wasn't what this provision is supposed to do. This provision was directed at historical immigrant quotas where there's quotas set by law from people from different countries. It wasn't intended to restrict the president's separate power to protect national security under the provisions like the 1182F provision that allows him to exclude someone if they would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. And, you know, they also cite some historical precedents for bans on the basis of nationality under President Reagan. Cuban nationals were for a time barred entry, and under President Carter, Iranian nationals were barred. So that issue will be before the court, whether the travel ban is in violation of that that provision. And then there's a constitutional issue in the case, which is there's an argument that the Establishment Clause is violated by this travel ban. The Establishment Clause is a portion of the First Amendment that prohibits preferential treatment of religions. It bars, for example, the government establishing a state church, but it's also been interpreted much more broadly than that to preclude the government from taking actions or passing laws or whatever that would preferentially treat one religion over another. The argument here is that the travel ban was motivated by anti-Muslim animus by President Trump, and the challengers have pointed to public statements by President Trump during the campaign where he called for a ban on Muslims entering the United States, and then subsequent later statements where he seemed to be arguing, you know, basically continuity between his previous, promises or proposals and what he's doing now. The government has responded to this basically by saying that, this particular, travel ban, this version 3 travel ban was the result of a comprehensive neutral review program that they undertook, which examined, hundreds of countries across the world and also the fact that of all of the Muslim majority countries in the world, it's only a very small number that are included in this ban, and those were and some were even dropped from previous versions of the ban, and certain categories of entries from others are allowed in under this. So to call it a Muslim ban would be very overstated, and it's based on these criteria related to their review was supposed to be about whether the nations in question had sufficient controls on identity documents and participated, cooperated in anti-terrorism efforts so that the United States could trust documents, travel documents, passports, and the like coming from those countries. And so they've argued that none of this violates the Establishment Clause. So that's the other issue that's there. There's another interesting procedural issue that's potentially at play in this case that's not directly related to the details of the travel ban, but it's the question of nationwide injunctions. And one feature of this case is that there's been on each version of the travel ban, the first, second, and third versions of the travel ban, there's been courts, district courts in different parts of the country that have issued injunctions ordering on a nationwide basis, ordering the government to halt the travel ban policy everywhere for everyone across the country. Traditionally, injunctions there's kind of a traditional approach to injunctions was that they only were binding in relation to the parties to the case, so that if certain plaintiffs bring an action and say that a law that's being applied to them is unconstitutional, then the government would not be able to apply it to those particular persons, but wouldn't be bound for any other people beyond those that were attached to the case. Now, there were procedures like class actions that would allow you to challenge something on behalf of all the affected parties by defining a class and doing it that way. But that has additional requirements, additional hoops that have to be jumped through to get a class certified, to have a court say that, yes, this meets the requirements to be heard as a class action. But there's been recently a trend of district courts in various different cases. This is often high profile cases of national importance where district courts have issued these nationwide injunctions, not only, barring the government from enforcing the policy, with respect to the challengers, but barring, certain things nationwide. And, it kind of came to a lot of people's attention during the, legal challenges to the DAPA program. That was President Obama's program. It was the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, which was, it provided, for a deferred status, immigration status for certain, immigrants who met, certain criteria who were the parents of, American born children. And a challenge was brought to that in Texas, and a Texas court issued a nationwide injunction barring the Obama administration from implementing that program. And at the time, that came under a lot of criticism from the political left, arguing that basically this was a way for conservative groups hostile to Obama's agenda to seek out a district where there was more likely to be sympathetic judges. So here they chose a district in Texas that was known for having very conservative judges where they would be more hopeful to get a judge to agree with their challenge and block the policy, and then it applied nationwide everywhere. But now under President Trump, we've seen the same thing repeatedly from people challenging the Trump administration's policies. It's happened multiple times in multiple cases in the travel ban litigation. But it also happened with respect to the President Trump's rescinding of the DACA policy. That's the Childhood Arrivals Immigration Deferral Program. And there was a nationwide injunction barring the rescinding of that. There was also a nationwide injunction related to the Trump administration's sanctuary cities policy. It's the Supreme Court hasn't squarely addressed this issue. The court has taken cases that involved nationwide injunctions, where the lower courts had issued nationwide injunctions, and the cases have come up to the court. But the court has never specifically clarified how they should apply or whether they were appropriate. It hasn't been an issue the court has really talked about. But one of the issues that was raised in the travel ban litigation that's coming up to the court. One of the questions that was presented to the court for the court to answer was about the proper scope of the injunction below. So this is a opportunity for the court to potentially to step into that question and give some guidance about when those types of nationwide injunctions might be appropriate. And then the second case that was granted, this is the case that just Monday this week, the 22nd, was granted, and this is the case again that will probably not be heard until October next year. So this is starting to fill out next year's calendar. It's a case called Weyerhaeuser Company v. United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and this is a case. It's under the Endangered Species Act. The case is about something called the dusky gopher frog, which is also known as the Mississippi gopher frog, which is an endangered species of frog that is currently found only in a couple very small populations in Mississippi. The complaint in this case, the issue here is this frog once inhabited a larger area and was found also in Louisiana and Alabama. Now, when the Fish and Wildlife Service, when they designate a species as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, they can designate critical habitat for that species. And when critical habitat is designated, that creates certain, special, restrictions on that land. For many uses of that land would now require special, permits from the Fish and Wildlife Service. And there's often conditions on those permits that require, taking actions to preserve the habitat for the species in question. And in some cases, the Fish and Wildlife Service will bar all development on the land completely, if it thinks that's necessary to preserve the critical habitat. Now what happened in this case, then the issue here is in addition to the existing habitat in Mississippi where these small populations of frogs are found, the Fish and Wildlife Service also designated some additional areas around there that are not currently inhabited, but have the necessary ecosystem where they could support the frog. But the Fish and Wildlife Service decided that even with that habitat, it wasn't sufficient to protect the future survival of this species. And so it also designated around 1,500 acres of private forest land in Louisiana. Now, the issue with that land is not only does the frog not live there, it hasn't been seen in Louisiana in over 50 years, but that designated forest area that's now been declared critical habitat is not currently inhabitable by the frog. It's not suitable for the frog. It does have necessary wetlands that the frog uses for breeding, apparently, but it doesn't have the open canopy forest that the frog lives in the non-breeding season. And it's accepted by all the parties that right now the frog can't inhabit that area. It just isn't a suitable location. So this designation has been challenged by this company, Weyerhaeuser Company, which owns or leases the land in question, uses it for timber harvesting, but also has plans that have been in the works for a while for some residential development in that area. And their basic argument is that the statute, the Endangered Species Act, in its provisions that allow for designating a critical habitat, in order to designate something for critical habitat, it must be habitat of that species, meaning it must be suitable and inhabitable by that species. And the argument is that this land, because it right now is the frogs can't survive on this land, it doesn't qualify as habitat of the species and therefore doesn't fit within the provisions of the Endangered Species Act. The Fish and Wildlife Service argues on the other side that basically the provisions that allow it to also designate currently uninhabited land doesn't require that it be currently habitable, only requires that it be essential for the conservation of the species. So there's just an argument there about whose interpretation of the Endangered Species Act is right. And there's, you know, some pretty large claims about the importance of this case. The challengers to this designation argue that if this interpretation is allowed to stand, then that would potentially put it in danger of a critical habitat designation, enormous portions of the United States for numerous species that currently aren't under the don't fall under the Endangered Species Act's coverage because the species is in question don't live in these lands right now. It remains to be seen what the court will do with that and how they'll look at what the statute actually requires. So that's the new cases that will be coming around. And again, as we get closer to argument for each of those cases, the merits briefs, those are the briefs actually arguing the case from the different sides and arguing who should win. Those will start coming in and we'll get an even better sense of the critical issues and what's really at issue in these cases. Right now, we're basing it mostly on the search stage briefing, so the briefs where they're urging the case to take or not take this case, which gets into the main issues, but not quite as deeply as the later briefs will. So, in addition to the orders and grants that I've discussed, the other big news this week is three new opinions. I mentioned there was three new opinions. Now, earlier today, I released three podcast episodes. They're available both as audio podcasts or as videos of me on YouTube. And these are listed as episodes 22, 23, and 24 of the podcast. They all came out today. And those are some pretty kind of a detailed look at each of these three opinions, where I really dig in and try and walk through the opinions a bit and examine the arguments that are being made. if you are interested in going into some more depth in these cases, then I encourage you to check out those episodes. Again, it's episodes 22, 23, and 24 of the podcast or the YouTube videos. But right now, I'm just going to try and give a really quick, brief sense of what these three opinions are about, but without getting down into the details. And again, feel free, for those that are watching live, feel free to ask any questions in the live chat if you have any as I go along. But let me just very quickly touch on each of them. The first case is called National Association of Manufacturers v. Department of Defense. Now, this was a unanimous decision. It was written by Justice Sotomayor. And this was a procedural case, and the basic issue was this. Under the Clean Waters Act, the Clean Waters Act is a pollution control regulation that's overseen by the EPA, and it dates back to the 1970s, and it covers something referred to in the statute as the waters of the United States. Now, there's been litigation for years over what exactly the waters of the United States means. How far does that cover? Obviously, it covers things like, you know, major rivers, but what about small ponds or drainage ditches or things like that? Are they waters of the United States? There's been lots of litigation over that. A few years ago, the Obama administration in 2015 issued a new rule. This came from the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, defining the term waters of the United States for purposes of the Clean Water Act. And what happened is there's been a challenge by numerous parties have challenged this 2015 definition, which is known as the WOTUS rule, WOTUS for waters of the United States. The problem here is that there's a provision under the Clean Water Act that says that certain types of challenges to EPA actions are supposed to go directly to the courts of appeals and not to the district courts. There's a dispute over whether challenges to this rule fall into those categories. And so there's litigation that's been ongoing for several years now over which court is the right court that this case should be heard in, whether it should be in federal district courts around the country or whether it should be directly in the courts of appeals. And so this is a huge problem because it's just held up the litigation. There's been all this fighting just over this procedural thing just to try and decide if they're in the right court rather than getting to the real issues at the bottom of it. And so in the opinion this week, the Supreme Court settled the matter and said that no, in fact, the challenges to the definition, this waters of the United States definition does not fall into any of those categories and belongs in the district courts, not in the Court of Appeals. So that resolves that going forward, and now they can actually go forward in the district courts and actually fight over the real issue, which is the dispute over the definition of waters of the United States and whether the regulation is a legitimate definition of that term. So that's what that case is about. Again, it's just a procedural issue, not a real exciting hot button case, but it kind of illustrates the importance of that these procedural rules sometimes play and the obstacle they can create in a case in some situations. So the second case is one that got a little more attention, a little more press. It's called District of Columbia v. Westby. And this is a case, and I had discussed it on one of the previous live streams. But this is a case about a house party in Washington D.C. And the police came to the party and found that the house that was apparently vacant, where there was a party with some 21 people, they rounded up in there, and there was all kinds of what was described in the opinion as debauchery and other terms like that. They found this kind of wild party going on there, and were told by some of the partygoers that someone named Peaches, known only as Peaches, and in the litigation was referred to only as Peaches, not known by any real name, had invited them there, had said that it was her house that she was leasing and that she had invited them there to the party. And the issue in the case was the police eventually talked to the owner of the house, who said that no, Peaches did not have permission to be there, and none of the partygoers were supposed to be there. The police arrested everyone for unlawful entry. And the what happened is the charges were dropped, but a number of the partygoers later sued the city and the police for false arrest, arguing that they didn't have there was no probable cause to arrest them because there was no reason to believe that they knew or should have known that they weren't allowed to be in the house. They said they believed they were authorized to be there because they'd been invited by someone who said that they were leasing the house. And without some of the police having some reason to believe that they knew or should have known that they weren't allowed to be there, then there was no grounds to arrest them and charge them criminally for unlawful entry. And what happened is the partygoers actually won in the courts below, in the district court and the court of appeals. They won, and they won a very sizable monetary verdict. But here, the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Thomas, reversed the lower court and said that the officers, from all of the circumstances of this party, the officers could make a reasonable inference that the partygoers knew that the house was vacant. I go into some more detail on the specific circumstances that the court cites in my other podcast episode about this opinion. But the court basically says, and in Justice Thomas's opinion, that you can't look at each piece of each circumstance that was seen by the police individually, one by one, and look for a reason why it might not have been incriminating. You have to look at the whole totality of the circumstances, all these things together, and ask whether taking all of these circumstances together, an officer might reasonably believe that the partygoers knew they were in a vacant house. So that was the first issue in that case, but there was a second issue in that case, which was whether the police, even if there wasn't probable cause, whether the police would have what's called qualified immunity, which is qualified immunity is a rule that protects police and other public officials from liability, even if they violate someone's rights, if it wasn't clearly established that they were violating the law. And so Justice Thomas goes on in the opinion to rule that citing previous Supreme Court opinions to say that in order for there to be clearly established law that the police were violating, there has to be cases that are pretty specifically dealing with the same type of situation with similar facts, so that it's clear from those previous decisions that that the current situation is governed by the same rule as those other cases. And the court says there just isn't anything like that in this case, so that the police do have qualified immunity. Now, this case was not completely unanimous. It was a 9-0 opinion in favor of the District of Columbia and against the party goers, but two of the justices, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg, didn't join the Justice Thomas's opinion. They had separate concurrences. Now, Justice Sotomayor had a very short concurrence, and she basically, all she said in hers was that she agreed with the majority on the qualified immunity determination. So basically there wasn't clearly established law that the police had violated someone's rights, so there was no liability. But she said, given the, highly fact-specific details of this case, and given that the qualified immunity decision resolves the case, with qualified immunity there can be no damages, therefore, the probable cause issue for the arrest doesn't matter at that point. And so she believed that the court shouldn't have even reached that issue. So she doesn't express an opinion on that part of the case, but thinks the court shouldn't have reached that. Justice Ginsburg has an interesting concurrence. She says that she ends up agreeing with the court on qualified immunity, saying that given the current state of the law, the court is right that the officers have qualified immunity. However, she casts doubt on whether the current state of the law is correct, and says that the court should reconsider one of its past precedents and a line of cases following it that says that when you, in a situation like this, you don't look at the subjective state of mind of the police that are engaged in the challenged activity. You only look whether they objectively had probable cause. And here she notes that the reason that the police officer actually a sergeant on the scene actually ordered all of the partygoers arrested was was arguably based on a misunderstanding of the unlawful entry law or the requirements of for probable cause for that, even though actual probable cause may have existed, that wasn't the reason that the officer at the time ordered people to be arrested. And under Supreme Court precedents, that it doesn't matter. As long as probable cause did exist, even if that wasn't the actual reason in the mind of the officer, then the arrest can be legitimate. And she questions whether that's whether the court should stick with that going forward, or whether it should reconsider that line of cases. Just as an aside on this particular case, there was a lot of amusement at the time this case was being argued about the mysterious character Peaches, who was never identified by name in the court filings and seemed to be an unknown, you know, mysterious figure that had been involved in this. Around the time, just after the case was argued back in October, the Washington Post had a profile of the mysterious Peaches that identified who she actually was. It turns out she was a woman named Veronica Little, who was a bartender at the Skylark Lounge, which is, I guess, apparently no longer in existence strip club in Northeast D.C. And apparently, as a bartender at this strip club, she would regularly arrange for dancers to perform at private events like bachelor parties. So she was apparently the organizer of this party at this house. However, she died about a year and a half ago at age 50 of respiratory problems. So she it was long after the events of this particular party, but it was before this case ever made it to the Supreme Court and before she ever got her 15 minutes of national fame as the mysterious Peaches. But that's just a little interesting tidbit about her. The third and final case that was decided this week was called Artis v. District of Columbia. This is it's a very technical case. It's about statutes of limitations. It was a sharply divided case, 5-4. Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion for what's often called the liberal wing of the court. So that's herself and also Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Breyer, and also Chief Justice Roberts, in this case, kind of the swing vote, making up a 5-member majority. And then the four other conservative members of the court were in dissent. The issue here, it's kind of a technical issue. Sometimes when a case is federal claims are brought in federal court, and in this case it was a Title VII gender discrimination claim. State claims that normally belong in state court can also be kind of tag along with the federal claim and be brought in federal court. But when those, if the federal claim is dismissed from the case, and that happened here, the Title VII claim got dismissed, the federal court can decide to also get rid of the state claims, and basically that leaves the plaintiff to have to refile those claims in state court. The issue is that the statute of limitations, so the period in which someone has to file a claim or else they lose their right to file that legal claim, that statute of limitations could run out while the case is pending in federal court. So to deal with this, there's a provision of federal law that is referred to as the tolling provision here, which essentially extends the statute of limitations for a period after the federal court dismisses those state court claims, drops those state court claims, to give the plaintiff a chance to refile them in state court. And the argument here was about whether the length of time, basically, that the statute of limitations would be extended. Would it be only for 30 days, or would it be for a longer period of time? And the details of that and why there are these two different conflicting interpretations is pretty technical, but I go into it in quite a bit of detail in the individual podcast about this case. So that's episode 24. If you're interested in the real details about that, but the justices on both sides really dig into the exact language of this provision and try and make their arguments about why it means one or the other of these two approaches. And the majority eventually decides under a rule that would in some cases allow for a longer period that would give extra time. So not just 30 days, but potentially longer period of time, depending on the details of the particular case. But again, if you want to hear the real, you know, the get kind of down into the details and hear the arguments that are going back and forth between the sides, please listen to episode 24 of the podcast. So with that, that basically wraps up the news for this week. And the, hold on 1 second as I'm just reviewing my notes, make sure I've covered everything I intended cover just now. Yep. That brings us to the end of this live stream. Our next live stream is going to be a week from today. That's Thursday, February 1st, again at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And I plan to keep holding these on a weekly basis, but you can always check the Counting to Five YouTube channel to find the next scheduled live stream. Now that the January oral arguments are finished, the court has a bit of a break right now. It has no scheduled, dates where the justices are going to be on the bench, no scheduled dates for handing down opinions or issuing new grants of new cases until the court returns in February for the next oral argument session. And that doesn't start until February 20th. There's always a possibility that there might be some sort of emergency orders or other unexpected developments, but there's nothing anticipated. So we're not expecting any new cases or any new opinions until at least February 20th. So given that there's not much going to be happening at the court in the next couple weeks, absent any big surprises, for the live stream, I'm going to take a deeper dive into a few specific cases. And for next week, the plan is to dig into Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And this is a case out of Colorado about a baker who refused to make a cake for a same-sex wedding ceremony and then was brought before the Colorado Civil Rights Commission for discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. I think this is a fascinating case. There's a lot to it. I'm going to try and look at it from a variety of different angles, but I also want to hear from you. If you have any questions about Masterpiece Cake Shop or any things you want me to address, please, you can send them to me or post them during the live chat during next week's broadcast. So I hope you'll join me next week for the live stream about Masterpiece Cake Shop. Whether you're watching on YouTube or listening to the audio podcast, I would love your feedback. You can leave your comments on the show notes post at countingto5.com, on the Counting to Five YouTube channel or Facebook page. You can tweet at Counting to Five or send me an email at mike@countingto5.com. And please subscribe either to the YouTube channel or to the audio podcast to make sure you don't miss future episodes. And thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.